Extension number 17437, Reel 1.
Mr. Bromley, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
Well, I was born in Brighton at the time, in 1921.
Did you have your schooling and upbringing in Brighton?
No, I was adopted when I was quite small and brought to Southampton. My foster parents were the name of Bromley, and we lived quite near to the Polygon in Southampton at the time. My adopted father used to go out on the big ships, the Montcalm and Aquitania. He was a master chef, baker, on board those ships, and used to be away from home quite a time. So I saw a lot of my mother, more or less, my adopted mother. From then, my father wanted me to go into the Navy, and he managed to find a place for me at a place called the Headlands in Penarth, Glamorganshire, and it was a naval training school. Later on, they were to convert it into a children's home, an orphanage, and I went down there, and they were there. One of the happiest years of my life, really. We'd done nautical training, rifle drill, knots and splices, navigation, and prayed. And during that period of time, as time went by, I left there to join the Royal Navy. I joined the Navy in about 1938.
Did you want to join the Navy yourself?
Yes, because a lot of the lads, as they grew older, joined the Navy from there. They used to, every so often, there would batch of lads that were reached the training age would leave and go to Whitehall for examinations and that. And when they came back, we used to crowd around them, you know, did you pass? And they, yes, we passed and that, and of course. Later on, I was to meet one of the lads. His name was Joe Knight. I don't know whether he's still alive or not. I met him and at Chatham Naval Barracks as a boy. I joined the Navy as a boy, and my first ship was the Hawkins. When I left the my first ship was the Hawkins, which I came from the Wildfire, HMS Wildfire, which was a training ship. And when we finished our training, we went to the Hawkins to finish off our training at sea, more or less. You know, you've got the gift of the what actually happened, the scrubbing decks, bugle calls, the messes and all that from there. later on, I was to pick up the Mohawk in Alexandria Harbour, in Alex at the time. And we went down from Alexandria Harbour, we went down to the Red Sea in Aden, and normal patrolling round and about. Just getting near towards the start of the war at the time, September 3rd, I think it was, September 3rd. And we were coming up to the Suez Canal when we got orders from the skipper that we were now at war. And one of our first jobs, I remember, was sitting on B gun deck with the shells, putting the fuses on the shells. And there was an old stripey there, a three-bed stripey, and he was showing us how to do it, how it's to be done. And we used to ask him all sorts of questions, because mind you, it was only young boys. And he explained to us that the purpose of the destroyer, this particular destroyer, was in a major engagement, was to go in to attack with the foremost guns firing, turn 90 degrees and fire the torpedoes at the enemy, then come out with the after guns firing. And he said, if you're lucky, he said, you'll last about 10 minutes. Well, you imagine. It put the fear of the Lord up us. However, we were supposed to make contact with four merchant ships which had left the various ports were crossing the Red Sea. But we never did come up with them at all. We either missed them or they didn't. It was a false alarm. And, of course, when we got back to Alex, it was in Alex, we were we were there on the war footing, as you might say. Spent a lot of time there. We were the fourth destroyer flotilla at the time, and we was and Captain Cunningham, and he's called him there, Admiral Cunningham at the time. And at one period there, we had before the actual war started, we had done patrolling Athens and Sardinia, and that was before the war. Before the war, we'd done the patrolling of these areas, but so we knew them quite well. So when war came along, we had to go and patrol again, contraband, which was going on. And
did you have an action station at this time?
Yes, yes. Well, we were moved around. I was on A gun for Akak, when we attacked by aircraft. And when it was a low angle firing, I was on the after control, controlling X and Y gun. And I had what you call a time clock there, which gave you range and deflections and all that. That was in case the TS, which was the main distributor of information to the guns, if it was knocked out of action, they could rely upon us to supply the necessary. It was a backup. On that time, those are the positions I had then. Well, we done, as I say, we done the patrolling out. We done the convoys, Battle of Calabria, Battle of Matapan, and with all these various battles, we looked. Hardly lost any men at all. It was amazing, really. But the proof of that was that before the war, we used to do a lot of night exercising. We used to exercise at night time, and we used to exercise against the Gibraltar fleet at Gib, and we used to call them the Reds and the Blues, and we used to exercise against one another, night actions. And believe me, if any time during the war, that put the fear of the Lord up me. You laid a smoke screen at night time, and you knew you were in formation, and then you had to alter course, and there was a smoke screen, and you couldn't see a thing. And the first thought came through your mind, you want to make big battle wagons and come plowing through that smoke screen and turn you over. But however, we had it off to a perfect T, and it was to help us later on, during the war, when we came against the Italian fleet in the Battle of Matapan, and we caught them at midnight, the Pola and Zara and Fiume. And of course, you know, the record of that is in the history books, the night action of Matapan. And
what do you remember about the battle?
Well, the Battle of Matapan, I was on an after control clock at the time, waiting for with the headphones on, waiting for instructions to come through for the X and Y gun at the time. And obviously there's times when you turned your seat, which was a swivel seat, and looked out the side door, and you could see the action going on. But mostly I was undercover at the time of the Battle of Matapan. Not until it was over did we leave the stations to pick up the survivors. And we had one survivor, which is quite a true story. We pulled one inboard. He was a German. And as he came up to the guardrail, he gave the Hitler salute, which one of the Australian ASDIC men, we had three on board, ASDIC operators, punched them on the jaw and sent him back into the water again. And told him that next time he comes on board to salute properly. So he was pulled in again, and he stood on the quarter deck and he stood to the White Ensign. So that put the tail end to him. That was the Battle of Matapan, and it was a great victory for us on the whole. The Battle of Cabaret took place more or less in the afternoon. We tried to catch the Italian fleet, but without luck, we couldn't catch them. And that's when the Italian battleship, I think it was the Vittoria or something, fired us over to keep us at bay, and one of the shells came right to on our port side, and I was on A gun at the time, at that time being, and it was the Battle of Calabria.
Which of the two battles made the most impression on you?
Which of the two battles? I think the Battle of Matapan, I think that was the most impressive of all the battles, too.
The Battle of Matapan was March 1941, I think.
41, yes.
So we seem to have jumped ahead quite a bit. If we can deal with the earlier part of the war, you were telling me about the contraband patrols in the Eastern Mediterranean.
Yes, that was before the war, before Italy came into the war. We would go up to Sardinia. We went to Sardinia, the port of Athens, Greece, patrolling the area around the Greek islands for any contraband that was being carried out, and that was pre-war. And it wasn't really much, just patrolling, going back to Alex, refueling, going out again. And as I mentioned before, we went off down the Mediterranean, and when we came back, we came back home. We came back home in 1939 and done the Norwegian campaign and the Belgium Hook of Holland. And it was the Norwegian campaign that we patrolled outside the fjords. We got caught one time in there. We were landing troops at Mo, and we landed them, and we got caught with the Condor or Junkers 88s, I think they were at the time, and we didn't have much room to manoeuvre, not in a fjord. However, we were lucky and we came out alive. And another incident was the Altmark, which is quoted in the naval history, the prisoners from the various merchant ships put on this this merchant ship and taken to Germany. However, she was in one of the fjords, and at the time we were getting ready to board her, and we were a junior officer, not a senior officer, we were a junior officer, a skipper was. And I remember very well, we were issued with the rifles and one thing and the other, you know, revolvers and that. And I remember one chap was issued with a cutlass, and he turned around to the gunner's mate and says, what the devil am I supposed to do with this? Well, he said, seeing you've had no cutlass drill, he said, the best thing you can do is, when you're charging the enemy, he says, run up and swing it round the end and yell like hell. He said, you scare the lights out of them. But for God's sake, he says, don't do it when I'm anywhere near you. However, shortly after that, we got an order to stand to, and the Cossack arrived. And she was senior and told us to abandon the what's him of boarding and to patrol outside the fjord. And she went in and more or less took the glory. However, that's it, he was a senior officer. Shortly after that, we went back to the Hebrides to refuel and all, and back to Scapa Flow. That's godforsaken place, that was Scapa Flow. Just nothing but mountains and sheep. I've never known a place like it. God, it was out of the way.
You were telling me earlier, off the record, coming back to Norway, about a Norwegian patrol boat.
Oh, yes, yes.
Put that story on the
yes. Tape, oh, that was only one journey. And we went back again. We used to do a week and fortnight. And at the time, it was cold and wet, my same, and we used to smell a B.O. Told you dared take your clothes off, it was so cold. And this little Norwegian destroyer. We were trespassing, really. This was before the Germans invaded Norway. We were trespassing in territorial waters. And this little tiny destroyer came out and sent us a signal and said, you are trespassing in our territorial waters. Would you kindly leave? So he said, so skipper said, well, yes. And the little Wasim destroyer signaled back, if you refuse to do so, we should be compelled to open fire on you, which we called a lot of amusement on the bridge at the time. However, we left the territorial waters, and it wasn't until the Germans invaded Norway that we used to meet up with the store again. And she was two other ships, which we escorted back to the Clyde. And that was when we were bombed, going up the Clyde. And this was the commander, Chef Jolly, who got mortally wounded. And the German pilot that bombed us was looking for the hood, but couldn't find the hood, and saw us instead. So he decided we were the right alternative. So two bombs dropped down on the port side, and they were shrapnel bombs. They exploded before they hit the water. So we had a lot of casualties on board at the time. We had a lot of wounded, and a lot of were killed. Plus the captain, Commander Richard F. Jolly, who was mortally wounded, but brought the ship in to the, I think it's Queensbury, Queen's Ferry, I think it's called.
This is the Firth of Forth.
Yeah, that's right, yes, that's not now. Brought the ship in and rang off main engines and died. A few days after, the funeral was held for all those to be shipmates to be buried. Then we left Rosyth, well, left the Firth of Forth to go down to Heppen-on-Tyne, where we came up against the Kelly, Captain Mountbatten. And during that period of time, we were being patched up, patches over the shrapnel holes on the ship. And when this was complete, we were ready for sea. Lord Haw-Haw announced on the German radio that the Mohawk and Kelly would never leave the Tyne. Well, apparently that night he must have sent some submarines out and mined the area, because next morning when we went out, the head of us was a minesweeper, mines were popping up in all directions, so we had to go back into Tyneside stern first. Later on, the Kelly was to get involved again, and which we took her in tow in one instant. I can't remember the exact action. It was a merchant ship on fire. She went to investigate it, and I think it was the German motor torpedo boat torpedoed her. I'm not quite sure. It's in the history books. And we had to tow her back into harbour. Then came the, shortly after that came the, when Norway fell, came the Belgium and Holland. And we went into Holland, the Hook of Holland, which was called in that time, went into the Hook of Holland, and we're supposed to give some heavy bombardment for the troops, but that was cancelled. And so we went into the actual hook itself, right deep into the hook, went alongside the jetty, and we took off a lot of merchants, with diamond merchants, and people of high rank in them, and there's quite, oh, let's say 400 or 500 or more together. And we put the gangway down, and we went down to give these refugees a hand, getting luggage on board so we could push off as quick as possible. And I went down at the time, and there was a woman there with a baby in her arms and a suitcase, and obviously I went towards her to give her a hand to carry a suitcase so she could come on board. Well, the alarm went, the action stations went, and it was panic, and the jetty, everybody running in a different direction, and it was three Blenheims belonging to the Royal Air Force that came over. They opened up on them, but spotted them, that what they were, and ceased firing. But in the meantime, I said to this woman to get on board as quick as she possibly could, and she handed me the baby. Well, by the side of the jetty was a huge bollard in which they used to tie the ships to, the wires and that. And when these planes came over, I could see them coming over, and I ducked down behind this with the baby in my arms, and the woman, I could see her going up to the gangway plank on board, and there were suitcases everywhere. The guns crew couldn't move the suitcases in the refugees, and eventually she started to call out for a baby and that, and of course, and I managed to leave the bollard where I was ducked down behind, and got on board and handed the baby to her. And a lot of the men gave their hammocks up to the refugees, and we proceeded out to sea, and back to Tilbury, where we landed refugees at Tilbury. Then, shortly after that, we were called to the Mediterranean. And this is where we started on to the convoy down Bomalley between Pantelier and Malta. And we was involved in a lot of convoys. One particular convoy we were bringing round to Malta from Gib. We met him at Gib. The Gallant had strayed onto a minefield near Pantelleria, which the Italians had laid the night before. I think the idea was to achieve what they intended to do, was to for some ships to run into the minefield. And the Gallant had her bows blown off, and we went in to pull her out. Now, we were going into a minefield, so I remember that time I was on the bridge at the time, and as a lookout, boy lookout. And I remember the navigating officer then was taking the bearings, every bearing, because the Aztec ratings were giving us the bearings of the mines. They could detect the mine from the Aztecs. From the Aztecs, they could detect them, being metal, they could detect where the mines were. So they were recording them on the chart. When we got to the Gallant, we had to tow her stern first out. We got a towing wire across to her. And then we had to go back the same route as we came in. Otherwise, we would end up the same as the Gallant. We towed her back to Malta. While we were towing her back to Malta, the towns decided to do some high-level bombing. And so we had quite a hectic time getting back to Malta with the bombing by the Italians. And eventually we got her back to Malta, and I understood that when we did get her back to Malta, she wasn't much good for repair. I don't think she ever made the sea again. That was HMS Gallant. And that was one of the incidents which we were involved in at the time. Possibly coming to the Calabria and Matapan actions. And well, we were based then. We were then up at Crete. The Crete action was going on. And we were based up there, and then we were with another destroyer, I think it was a Nubian and Mohawk, were sent back to Malta. They were having trouble with the convoy leaving Italy, going to North Africa, reinforcing Rommel. We arrived at in Malta, and another two destroyers, the Jervis and James, joined us, under Captain Mack. He was senior. We were still junior and last in the line. And a convoy was reported by the RAF, and we slipped out at night time, and it got dusk, and like we always used to, slip out at night time, and it was dusk, so that we wouldn't be observed by spotter planes that we had left. And we should try to get back there before dawn in the morning, so when the spotter planes came over, or whatever plane was photographing, would still see us there, not really like we'd been out on patrol the night, during the midnight. Now this particular night, we met this convoy, which is well recorded I think it was Roskill's war with the Navy, of the Navy, in the Mediterranean. being last in the line, we were lying ahead, and we attacked the convoy, and the other ships, the other destroyers, Jervis and Janus and Newman, were ahead of us, and they went round, and a merchant ship tried to ram us, and we had to avoid her, and I remember the ship going heeling over, and then there was a mighty explosion, and the quarterdeck was blown completely away, and I remember seeing the quarterdeck. It wasn't a sign of life of anybody, and we didn't think anybody survived. Not until later, years and years later, did we come across one survivor. Oral, his name was. It was Simon Oral, who survived the quarterdeck. All the guns crew, the whole lot was gone, depth charges. And there's nothing there in the water. I saw it from my own eyes. There's nothing there. And the order came out, battened down. And we battened down the hatches, the one particular that went to the wardroom. And I heard some crying out from down below, and I said to the PO in charge, "Oh, there's men down there, can we get them out?" He said, "No." He said, "You don't sacrifice a whole ship just for two or three men. Batten down." So we battened down the hatch, and he said, "You can now go up on the bridge and tell the captain that we have battened down watertight aft." So up I went on the beach, and Commander Eaton was up on the beach at the time, and I went to the beach and told him that Pio had sent me up, that we were secure down aft. And just then an engineer officer came on, and I was waiting with instructions as to what to do next. The engineer officer came up, and the captain turned around to him and said, "Well, engines, what can we do? What's the situation?" Well, he says, "We've got one screw left, and we can get back to Malta on it." "Oh, good. Well, will you see what you can do?" So off went the engineer officer. And he hadn't gone 2 minutes when the second torpedo came in, hit us amidships. Now, we understood from the various books later that it was the Torrigo had fired her torpedoes. She was badly on fire because we had fired at her, and she was badly on fire, and she had fired a torpedo to lessen the weight so she could survive and get away. But one of these torpedoes, as we were diving around to avoid this merchant ship, hit our stern, that was the what's name, and the second one came in, one of the other torpedoes came in, and hit us amidships. Well, then that was enough, we were going over. Then we got the order to abandon ship. And I was on the bridge at the time, and the captain turned round and said, "Right, lads, abandon ship, every man for himself." So I blew up my lifebelt and stood on the bridge and jumped into the water. Mind you, I heard later on that I jumped the wrong side. I should have jumped the other side because we were going down on the port side. However, I survived and I was swimming away there, and there's nobody else around at the time. I couldn't see anybody else. And I heard some singing on a raft roll out of the barrel. So I made for this. I was doing the overarm at the time, and I was making for this raft. And with the raft going up and going down, disappearing and going up and disappearing, they were singing. So I made my way towards the sound of the singing. And I heard a voice behind me say, "Don't do the overarm, do the breaststroke. It's much easier." So I turned around, stopped and turned around, and there was this dark figure. Couldn't see who it was, just somebody, black all over. Couldn't make a head or tail of it. So I carried on. I got to the raft and they helped me. I was sick for the first time in the Navy. Oil fuel got in my stomach. And I was sick for the first time. And they pulled me in and I said, "There's another chap behind me." And they said, "There's nobody behind me. We've been watching you. There's nobody behind you at all." I said, "Yes, there is. They told me to do the breaststroke, because the overarm was tarring. There's nobody been behind you." Well, I thought this was rather strange. You know, it was just... Well, it wasn't 2 years later that I met the son of Tanky, the chap that was on board the ship. I met his son, Eddie Cantor, who told me his father had told him the same thing, that when the ship was going over, two men helped him out of the hatchway because he was wounded, and one of them was a man in black. He just completely blacked. He couldn't, due to the confusion, he just couldn't put a face to him. The other bloke was clear as anything, but not the other chap. And I said, I said to the young son, I said, "It's strange, because I had the same chap behind me in the water." I said, "It's uncanny, so whether you, whatever it was, I don't know to this day." But to be confirmed years and years later that his father had seen this man in black, and I'd seen him,